accession number 28776, reel 17.
One, two, three, four. Admiral Sir Raymond Ligor, reel 17. What was the next posting, Admiral, after Lowestoft?
After the... I'm just trying to think. It's terrible, isn't it? Because my memory is not as good as it used to be. I must have gone back to the Admiralty. Yes, I must have done. I was a newly promoted commander. I had been on the staff of Flag Officer Aircraft Carriers. Then it was Lowestoft. And then... Wait a minute. Oh, no, I know what happened then. I suddenly got an appointment as commander of the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. And I thought, oh, this is the end of my career. I mean, I can't see hell. So I went and saw Dunbar Naismith. By this time, we'd sailed. Oh, that was an interesting episode here. Before sailing for the United States, we were alongside in Portsmouth with Berwick. And Berwick and Lowestoft, both of most modern, at that time, Type 12s. And we had a thing called a Cambria table, which was a new plotting table. Whereas previous we'd had, I never knew because I never involved in it very much, plotting by hand on charts. The Cambria was a radar projected image of the surrounding area with your ship in the middle. So when you looked at the table, big plotting table, you could see all the other ships on there, on radar, plotted around you, and you could put little symbols on them, and then you got the entire surface picture. Also, you could project on that any sonar contact, so you got the underwater picture as well. So it was quite an advanced system. And we were to be sent to the United States to show this system working to the United States Navy with the fond hope that they would buy it. Having spent a lot of time in America on exchange, I knew damn well they'd never buy it, because they'll never buy something like that. They'll always say, well, we've got something better coming along, which they probably had. They had a thing called then coming along called NTDS, the Tactical Development System, which was extremely complicated, and I thought pretty disastrous. But however, that's another story. The engineer who had stood by the building of Lowestoft and had been the chief and the first part of the commission was relieved by an ex-submariner engineer who, of course, had been used to diesels. Now he was faced with the famous Y-100 engines. And we were just doing a normal kind of maintenance in there. And I was visiting another ship that was alongside at that time. And when I came back on board, in mess undress, of course, I was greeted by the first lieutenant or the officer of the day, I can't remember, whoever, saying to me, we've got a problem, sir, and the chief wants to have a word with you. So I said, because we were supposed to flash up, start flashing at like 11 o'clock for sailing at 7 o'clock the next morning. So I said, what's the problem, Chief? And he said, well, there's a valve down in the boiler room that should be passing steam and it isn't, and I don't understand why. So I've shut down. So I said, oh. Now, this meant we were going to be late sailing and miss and wouldn't be able to sail with the Berwick. So I said, well, all right, let's... I said, well, I just want to think about it. All right. So the next thing is, he still wasn't satisfied with it. I said, right, call out the squadron engineer officer who was a commander in the Berwick. So he was called over. He was what I call a shiny tie type chap. In other words, he wore one of these shiny black ties, you see. I always reckon those were smoothies, those people that wore those ties, more interested in their appearance than their ability. So anyway, he came, and I went down. There they all were, poring over these charts. All right. And this went on. The next morning, there was nothing, and still, and then they were going to call the dockyard, and I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. So I phoned up the old ex-chief, who was then up in Caledonia. And he said, well, I don't know what he's talking about, sir. Unless I was there, I couldn't tell you what it is that's going wrong. So I said, well, anyway. So finally, you know, it was the next night, and nothing had happened, and they were still poring over diagrams. I said, I got hold of the petty officer who was in charge of flashing up. And I said, when you flashed up last night, what was everything? He said, everything was normal. So I said, all the gauges were coming up normally? Yes, sir. And the kettles were boiling? Yes, sir. Nothing wrong? No. You couldn't see anything abnormal that was happening? No. I said, right. So I said to the engineer, we're going to flash up. And he said, well, I can't. I don't think that's very wise, sir. I said, well, it may not be, but you're going to come down with me in the boiler room, and we're going to flash up. And if the thing blows, we'll both go out together. So he drained a bit, and down we went, and I gave the order, flash up. And we flashed up, and it was perfectly normal. Nothing wrong at all. Warm through the engines, ready to go. Sailed. I was about 24 hours late, but I caught her up. By the time we got into Bridgeport, Connecticut, I was there. Now, here's an example of experience over kind of detailed, pettifogging, bloody knowledge. I didn't know anything about the flashing up procedure, except that it would have gone normally. I mean, you know, why was this suddenly going to hold the whole thing up? But that's how it can happen, and how ships can get delayed, and endless cost and expense. Anyway, the point of my story is, when we arrived in Bridgeport, the mail arrived, and in there was a letter from the appointer saying I was going to be the commander of the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. And I blew. I said, I don't want to go. And I got out the Navy list to look, and I saw to my horror that the chap I was relieving was a pusser. So I was going to relieve a supply officer. I just don't believe this. And so I went to see old Crowbar Newswift, and I said, it's ridiculous, sir. I'm not going to do it. And he said, he always said it's a very good appointment. Very good appointment, Ray. And he said, it's a promotion appointment, that. And I said, I don't care what it is. I said, the fact is, I'm not, you know. Anyway, I was finally calmed down. We did the demonstration, which was fine. And all the US Navy officers that saw it thought it was marvellous, but I knew that they would never buy it. Old Crowbar Newswift was very full of joy. He thought, you know, this is it, we're going to persuade them. And I had to say very gently to him, so I'm sorry, I just don't think they will. However, it was a good visit, I suppose, as visits go. The wardroom got very heavily involved in a club that was in Bridgeport, Sailing Club, and one of the members was a fellow called Rothschild, which wasn't bad, and I finished up inviting two of them, because we were then going to Bermuda, to come to Bermuda with us, and they couldn't believe it. I said, yes, well, I've got accommodation if you want to come. So they came to Bermuda, and we then sort of got rid of those. But anyway, that was it by the way. My next job then was as commander of the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. So in a high state of mutiny, I presented myself to Greenwich. The captain at that time was an observer who had been the operations officer of Indefatigable during the war. And what's his name? Buchanan Dunlop. And he was a very Edwardian type officer. So I went into his office to present myself, which was in almost dark, except the lights on his desk were on. And one thing the commander was supposed to do was to carry a stick with a silver knob on the top. And I said, I'm buggered if I'm going to carry a bloody silver-headed stick. Anyway, I went in, and he was on the phone. He said, sit down, my dear fellow. My dear fellow, I thought, what's all this about? So I sat down, and he was on the phone. He was just saying, he was saying yes. Long silences. Yes. And then at the end, and how is Betty, or whatever? And then he said, got him. Got him. Put the phone down. He said, there's a lesson for you. He said, Ray. He said, if you're dealing with an awkward man on the phone, don't answer him. And after a while, he has to agree with you, because you haven't got anything else to say. And he said, and finally, I remember the name of his wife, and he couldn't remember mine. So, and he then said, now, my dear fellow, this is, I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the atmosphere, I couldn't believe the attitude. And all the fire went out of Ligo, and I went out and bought a bloody stick. And so I became commander of Greenwich. And I proceeded in my usual way to reorganise the whole bloody place, and it hadn't been reorganised for a hell of a long time, and every time I lifted a stone, some kind of animal ran out from underneath it. I mean, I won't bother to tell you the things I got up to there, but I did. But of course, within 6 months, when the next list came out, I was on it to be promoted to captain. So I had to serve out my six months' notice in those days, serve out my time, knowing I was going to be promoted captain, and actually served as a captain there for a few weeks before my relief arrived, and then went off to my next posting. But the family enjoyed it thoroughly. I mean, my children were quite small, and there was a Royal Marine physical training instructors there with absolutely nothing to do, really, because the college was running down by this time. And so they had a marvellous time, and it was an entirely different world for me, something I'd never experienced before. And so I suppose, looking back on it, it was an enjoyable incident. Certainly, I think the family enjoyed it. And there was one marvellous episode there, which the commander inherited, of course, a steward who was a civilian, and his name was, what was his name? Gone, it'll come to me in a minute. And he took a very great interest in the commander and his family, and was always relating what Lady somebody, who had been a previous commander's wife, used to do, you know. And that, of course, Pepper was sufficiently laid back to ignore all of this. But I was having trouble, can you believe it, I think, with piles. And I'd got these bloody, whatever you call them, capsules to stuff in to clear. Excuse me, to help mitigate or alleviate these problems. So he said to my wife, I used to go back there for coffee every morning. He said to my wife, is the commander taking his medicine? And my wife said, well, I think so. Yes, I think so. He said, did he take him this morning? She said, well, I'm not sure. He said, well, perhaps, he said. When he comes from the coffee, he said, we could slip one in. And he won't note it. And my wife nearly collapsed. He thought it was something I was taking as a pill, you see. Perhaps we could slip one into his... So we really enjoyed that little episode. But that was Robbie, it was his name, Robbie. Marvellous chap. Who gave us his present he gave us for Christmas was the beautiful crinoline lady television lamp. And it was the most hideous bloody thing you've ever seen. But of course, we had to have the damn thing on the television from then on. But it was all part and parcel of the fun and games at that place at that time. But I enjoyed it. But it was a certain amount of sorting out. I remember, I thought the chief steward, who was a man called Sutton, I seem to remember, was up to no good with the affairs of the college, and when I sent for him one day, I said, I want to see Mr. Sutton. Oh, he's gone ashore. I said, is he? So I called the police and said he's to be arrested when he returned. Brought before. I mean, all the, these were all civilians. And I mean, I had no authority to do this whatsoever, but it was all done. And they were all kind of scared stiff of me, I think. But anyway, we managed to sort. One of the things I discovered, of course, the college gave marvellous dances and things for the college, you know, and it was a lovely facility and everything. And we had marvellous caterers there. I mean, they were employed by the college, in the college. And all the food that was left over was distributed, I discovered, to the people who were in residence, which were the captain and the various people and the head of the Naval Staff College. And I said, well, this is no good. I mean, this all this money belongs to the members of the mess, most of whom are sub-lieutenants. And so we I stopped all that, and so they had to pay for whatever they had, and because it went back into mess funds. But that wasn't exactly the most popular thing to do with some of the senior people there, but there it was. It was the correct thing to do. And the other great thing I got involved in was I became, because I was at the command of the college, head of the wine committee. And what I knew about wine, you could put, you know, put on the back of a tuppenny stamp. So we held the first meeting. No, that's right. We held the first meeting of the wine committee. And there were various august professors on this thing. And my opening remarks were, right, so this is the meeting of the wine committee. I now refer to the minutes of the previous meeting. There are no minutes of the previous meeting, and therefore I conclude that it was improperly conducted. Whereupon one of the members, one of the eminent professors, said, are you inferring that this was not something? I said, well, I have to state the obvious. I mean, there aren't any minutes, so I don't know what happened, and I can only assume that it was not properly conducted. You will see my solicitor in the morning. I've never forgotten it. I was in the middle of a great fracas before I knew where I was. It was all I found, you know, several amazing things. For example, that a couple of them used to be sent to Portugal to taste the port. Before, I mean, can you believe it? I mean, it was all so blooming incestuous. And at the end of it, I decided that we would have blind tastings and that Naffy would be one of the contenders. Naffy and two other, maybe three people, putting wine forward to be tasted, to be selected, with brown paper wrapper. I mean, can you imagine? Because the net result for the average kind of chap is that after he's tasted the first one, he has no idea about any other wine. So I was then received a call to say, I understand that you are thinking of changing the wine supplier. And I said, no, I don't think I'm changing it. I'm just opening up the competition. Well, I think that's very unwise. Very unwise. I think if you do that, but I mean, you just leave things as they are, and you'll never have to buy another bottle of wine for the rest of your naval career. I thought, if you thought I can be bought by a few bottles of bloody wine, you've got another thing coming, mate. Anyway, that's what we did. And I don't know what happened after I left, but that was what was happening up until I left. But anyway, so I remember my wife talking very sharply to me once. I was driving out in the car, and as I drove out, there were two of our students walking along with their hands in their pockets. I wound the window down, take your hands out of your pockets. And my wife really flew at me afterwards and said, how dare you talk to me in front of me like that? It's so embarrassing. I said, well, they've got their bloody hands in their pockets. What do you think? But anyway, it was an interesting experience, shall we say. And I reckon I was a fully paid-up member of the ecclesiastical requirements of the Navy for life after that, because I used to have to go to church every morning for prayers, and every Sunday we were, oh, dear, oh, dear. As a kind of agnostic, it was a bit of a chore for me. But anyway, there was. It was all done, and that was the end of it. But so that was that. And the next, of course, thing I was sent to do was, I think, the Admiralty, of course, once again, as Deputy Director of Naval Air Warfare, right in head first into the Healy Defence Review, which wasn't a pleasant experience, because we lost a lot. Lost the carriers, and that was an enormous failure. So that was that. How much longer did you... I was promoted, I don't know whether I was second shot to captain or first shot, I can't remember. And I'd only just... about 6 months, so that rather threw us kind of pepper in the pond, and I had to stay there as the commander. In those days, but we were given 6 months' notice, so you knew you were going to be promoted in 6 months' time, and in my case, that was at the end of the year, and they hadn't got a relief signed up for me or lined up, so I stayed as the commander of British. As a captain, but only for a couple of weeks, until the new chap arrived. And I think they were, or a lot of people at Grange were very relieved to see me depart, because I kept lifting up stones, and every time you lift up a stone, a whole bunch of animals ran out from underneath it. But I then went for my first job as a captain to the Ministry of Defence. And at that time, the election was looming, and we had a Conservative administration, and the Navy Minister was an awful nice man, who had to resign over the forfeits later on. Anyway, well, I think of his name in a minute. But, and the Navy had been successful. My successor in particular, who was Winkle Brown, my successor in the Admiralty, my predecessor in the Admiralty. And I was the deputy director of Naval Warfare. The director was George Baldwin. And what my predecessor had achieved was to persuade the going for a common carrier for the Navy and the Air Force, and it was called the 1154. And the naval variety was to be a fighter, and the Air Force variant was to be a ground attack aircraft. Not a combination that's ever been very successful, and of course the problem with weight in the aeroplane and the radar that you needed persuaded the Navy that they were wrong to go for the Harrier and V-Stole, that they should go for conventional aircraft. And they got the government's approval to go for the Phantom, the F-2H, from the States. Rather than go for the Harrier, and we're told if you can do it for the same price, then you can have the Phantom. So they won that argument, and they were going to get the Phantom. So when I arrived at the Ministry of Defence, we had got ourselves into a situation where we had the Phantoms on order. We had gone to the Buccaneer 2 Star, which is an improvement in the Buccaneer. They've seen its radar and electronic warfare capability. And we had a not very good helicopter, which was the Wessex 3, an excellent helicopter in terms of its capability, but it had a very short endurance, so it really wasn't a very successful helicopter. And we were going for the Gannet. Replacement for ASW. But so the first thing that had to be done was to decide whether we really wanted to go for the Gannet as well as an advanced helicopter, and there really wasn't room in the carriers at that time to do this. They had also, that my predecessors had pushed through the CV-AO1 concept, so a new carrier was to be built which the design of which had been approved, and it was going to be a parallel deck carrier, by the way. In other words, it wasn't going to be angled, it was going to have two a landing and a takeoff parallel decks. A big ship. And so all this was in hand. And I remember going to a dinner in some one of the SBAC dinners, I suppose. And my previous admiral, who had been Charles Evans, came up behind me when I was sitting there and said, "How's it going, Ray?" And I said, "Well, it's going very well. We've got CVA 01, we've got a new generation of Buccaneers, we've got the Phantom." And he listened to this and then he said, "Have you yet to learn, Ray, that the pot of gold for the Fleet Air Arm is always over the next hill?" And I thought, oh, and golly. Within a few months, we'd had a change of government. Healy had come in, and we were about to lose everything. And I suppose, to be honest, we were unprepared for this. Whereas the Air Force were very prepared for what they had to do. Because what Healy succeeded in doing was setting the Air Force and the Navy at each other's throats. Now, when I say the Air Force and the Navy, that's not strictly true. It was the Air Force and the Fleet Air Arm. The Navy as a whole was somewhat divided still about the effect of aircraft carriers and what this meant to the naval budget and estimates in terms of escorts and other of varieties of ship, which they saw the carrier as pushing out of the program. So there wasn't a kind of unified structure within the Navy. Also, and this didn't occur to me at the time, but I've learned about it subsequently, there was a strong body of feeling within the Navy that we'd gone for the wrong type of carrier. We should have gone for a smaller carrier, of which we could have had more. But as it was, we were going to be left with a very odd fleet. And that fleet was, at that time, to consist of CVA-1, Eagle, and Hermes. Well, now, Hermes was a very small carrier compared to CVA-1 and even Eagle. And so, you know, you had three carriers, and we then started into this internecine warfare with the RAF. And I remember going to my first meeting where we were going to examine, in principle, whether we needed aircraft at all at sea and whether that could all be done from shore bases. And we, frankly, in the Navy, saw this as such a ludicrous proposition. We really didn't take it seriously. Well, not as seriously as we should have done. And I went to my first meeting, and I was a junior captain, and I was faced with, I think, five air commodores. And there was an air commodore fighter, an air commodore strike, an air commodore AW, which was amusing because they hadn't got any, and an air commodore anti-submarine, and he came from maritime aircraft, and an air commodore something. I mean, there were more air commodores that you could shake a stick at, and LIGO on the other side, that's all there was. And so when I was asked by the scientists, because what Healy had done is, having recognized that he could never get the services to agree probably on anything, the only thing he could do was bring in independent adjudicators, as it were, and he picked on the scientific service. Now, our scientific service at that time, and this was in a good post-war period, the best people that had all been developed during the war had gone. They'd all left the service or retired or gone off to do something slightly more lucrative. So the bunch we had left, I mean, I'm sure were all jolly nice chaps, but what they knew about warfare and the difficulties and the problems that faced the operators in the field was zero. And so it was very difficult to explain to them some of the requirements and the pressures that come on people who have to kind of come to terms with reality. and it's not like sitting in an armchair with a piece of paper. It really isn't. But, of course, you've got yourself into an environment, whereas if you said that, then immediately Healy or the politicians would say, oh, well, you're just, that's just a smokescreen, you just are trying to avoid the issue. So it was very, very difficult. I remember once going public and saying to Healy, you can't put morale into a computer. You can't. I mean, morale is the most important aspect of capability. But how do you define it? How are you going to measure it? It's very difficult to persuade people who haven't had to have that experience. And Healy, remember, was an ex-major in the army. And there was a story going around when I was still fairly young that at the end of the war, out in the Far East where he was serving, he asked to come on board to get, because he was going to stand for Parliament, to make a political speech, which he proceeded to do. The captain stopped him and ordered him off the ship. So I don't think that perhaps if it was true endeared him, particularly perhaps to the Navy.